A podcast of the cinema. It's time to go really fast. Yes, we have a lot of ground to cover, and Dave has places to be.
Yeah, I do have places to be. And as I was saying before we started the show, if you'd wanted it to be a leisurely paced episode, then you should have started earlier like I told you to. But no. Someone had to luxuriate in his Thanksgiving leftovers lunch. Somebody was lollygagging.
Well, I had other stuff to do today.
Slow moving.
I don't even want to hear slow moving from you.
Yeah. So,
that's fine. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. We both write stuff for The Wrap, and
let's not be.
Fine. I'm your boss at The Wrap.
It's okay. Don't get excited and too freaked out about our time limit.
Time's
here.
Time's wasting.
No, it's not. Everything is great. I write for The Wrap sometimes. You're the boss man. You're the
Film reviews.
You're the film reviews editor of The Wrap. You're also on What the Flick.
Yes.
This is a podcast where we talk about movies.
Yep.
We are married to each other.
That too.
We are brought to you by people like yourself. We'll talk about that later. In our, we're honing down our Patreon pitch. At first, they were long and rambling, but I'm getting us now to the place where I think if we can hit it in like 15 to 30 seconds per episode, that's enough of a commercial for us.
We will also tell you about how you shopping on Amazon can buy us fiber. Won't that be exciting?
That's much less important than everything else.
People are shopping at Amazon a lot right now. So, you know, Cyber Monday is upon us and all.
All right. So we have 6 movies to talk about.
Yes.
Moana. L, Bad Santa 2, Rules Don't Apply.
Best Worst Thing.
The Best Worst Thing that ever could have happened.
Mm-hmm. And Miss Sloan.
What is Miss Sloan?
Miss Sloan is a drama.
I didn't see it.
You didn't miss much.
Great. Let's move on.
It's from John Madden, the director of Shakespeare in Love. It stars Jessica Chastain as a hotshot Washington lobbyist who would appear to have no gig that she would say no to until a Southern senator who's being backed by the NRA tries to get her to make guns more attractive to women, because women tend to be the biggest opponents of gun safety regulation. She is not only turns down the job, but leaves and goes to the sort of what she calls the hippie lobbyist, the hippies with ties lobbyist shop across town to try and pass a background checks law. And this is, of course, really hard to do, and she faces an uphill battle, but she's really good at what she does. And, you know, the nuts and bolts and sausage making of legislation is the best part of this movie. And there's this whole relationship that she has with Gugu Mbatha-Raw as one of the lobbyists at the upstanding lobby joint, who, you know, she's always great.
I sure do like that Gugu Mbatha-Raw.
What the movie doesn't do, however, is explain who Miss Sloan is. Like, she is this bag of pill-popping ticks, and, you know, she's very much this kind
she's
of...
a bag of ticks?
Basically, yes. Rocky Mountain spotted fever ticks. T-I-C-S. And, you know...
What am I a bag of?
You're a bag of manias. You know, so she's got all the trappings of the sort of contemporary cable TV complicated hero slash heroine.
Yes.
You know, she's a pill popper and she's ruthlessly good at her job and she, you know, is always perfectly coiffed and well-dressed but, like, has a bad relationship with her dad and, you know, whatever.
Right.
But the movie doesn't ever really slow down enough to give her a real character to be. And so it's like if this were a pilot, you'd know that somewhere around episode 8 we might start getting some insight as to, you know, yep. who this Don Draper is. But... it's a movie, and so we don't. Which is not to say that Jessica Chastain isn't acting the crap out of it, but it's to little avail. And then there are these sort of third act switcheroos that I just found appallingly ridiculous. The guy who wrote me at the Wrap to tell me he was never going to read my reviews again,
and he was right,
seemed to think those were very well crafted. And a listener of this program, whom I shall not mention, went to see it last night and raved about it on Facebook. And my only comment was, "Girl." So who knows? Other people are clearly getting.
Wait! Did you just put a listener on blast?
Yeah, he knows what he did. He liked Miss Sloan. So maybe I'm in the minority here, but...
Hey, yeah, here's an idea.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen this film.
No.
What if you're completely wrong?
That is not a possibility. I refuse to even entertain that as a possibility.
Okay, so we're done talking about that film.
It's a slick bit of business, but nothing special. Jake Lacy has his shirt off a lot, and he's clearly gone to a trainer.
Okay. Did he not have a trainer before?
I never have seen him this shirtless in a movie before, but he's playing...
I don't know that I've ever seen him shirtless in a movie.
Well, he is playing her man whore with a heart of gold.
Is that what he calls himself in the film, a man whore?
No, but that's basically... I mean, he is her escort.
Except they
don't leave the hotel room, I'm sorry. So that's, you know...
Is he a sex worker?
Yes.
Okay, and he's there to American gigolo her?
Yes.
I always heard that that was not a real thing.
Here's the thing. I bet it's a real thing, but I bet they...
I mean, it has to be a real thing somewhere.
Sure. No. I think there are plenty of wealthy women who, for time or other reasons,
right.
you know, want to pay some strapping young handsome gentleman for his time, his penis.
His
horizontal time.
His penis.
Penis, fine. Yeah, all right. But what I doubt is that those guys make enough money just on women that they don't also have male clients.
Oh, I see.
Just a hunch.
We don't learn that about Jake Lacy's
character. It is not mentioned, no.
Okay. I guess, you know, it's almost inevitable that the guys are going to wind up going to trainers.
Oh, yeah,
superhero movie that requires them to, you know.
The superhero movies have leveled the playing field. Like, for women who had to, like, just show up in a negligee for no apparent reason in an otherwise stately drama,
right.
dudes now have to, like, be ready to whip that shirt off and have, like, you know, the V.
Right.
So, right. yeah, it's anybody's ball game now. Equality!
If I were an actor... I would just be the guy in the Dunkin' Donuts commercials. It was like, time to make the donuts.
You would be the character actor, yes.
I'd be the character actor. I have a face of a character actor, so that is what I would be. I would be the cop or the, you know, the plumber.
The hot dog cart
man. The hot dog cart man, yeah. Yeah. First, I'd have to learn to be an actor.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a big stepping stone there.
Yes. Are we done with that one?
I think so. Yeah.
Time.
That's all I got to say about Miss Sloan.
Let's keep moving on with other movie that I did not see. Rules Don't Apply.
Okay, which is,
I hear that
dying an ignominious death at the box office.
Yeah, that's what I hear. I hear that almost absolutely no one went to the movie theater.
Yeah, it had a per screen average like under $700. Which I'm sure someone...
That's not funny, but it's also very funny.
Someone will do the math about like how many people that comes out to per theater. Because you got to figure any given weekend has at least 10 shows, right? Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That's on the low side, 10 shows.
Sure, yeah.
So then that becomes, what, $70 per show? That's how many tickets? I mean, it's not good. Which is too bad, because Warren Beatty is one of our sort of great living filmmakers, but... He's not one of our great prolific filmmakers. This is the first movie he's directed since Bullworth.
Right.
It is kind of a story about Howard Hughes, but a good deal of it is devoted to two fictional characters who operate in Hughes's orbit.
Okay.
One is a driver whom he has just hired, played by Alden Ehrenreich. Beatty plays Hughes, by the way. And the other is an RKO starlet named Marla, I believe, who played by Lily Collins, who has newly arrived in Hollywood with her mother, played by Annette Bening.
Okay.
The drivers are forbidden from having relationships with the actresses, but these two wind up growing close anyway. He has, you know, bigger plans, and he wants, like, Howard Hughes to invest in this real estate opportunity that he knows about. She is a singer and a songwriter and has aspirations to being a movie star.
Right.
But she discovers, of course, that there are, like, all these other, you know, RKO contract girls that Hughes keeps in houses, and they have their own drivers so that he can keep an eye on them, basically.
Yes.
So there's this movie about Howard Hughes and about his increasing eccentricities and his efforts to hang on to his, you know, his companies, his TWA and all of his defense contracts and running RKO and all this stuff in Hollywood. And then it's also a movie about this actress and this driver. And individually, they would make interesting movies, but they never quite merge into being one movie. Like, the two of them don't really impact Hughes's life that much, and neither vice versa. And if he does, it's like, well, they're fictional anyway, so who cares? So it's gorgeous, you know. I mean, he's hired all the best cinematographers and costume people and that kind of thing. There's a theme song, you know. This is very kind of old school filmmaking.
What do you mean?
There's a at one point she writes a song called Rules Don't Apply and sings it throughout the film. And it's a nice ditty, you know, but like, you haven't, like, movies haven't had theme songs in a long time, you know. So it's very old school, and you know, Beatty comes from that era. Like, when he was starting out in Hollywood, Hughes and RKO were a thing. Like, yes, he dates back that far. Like, yes, this is a guy who was on, you know, the many loves of Dobie Gillis,
right?
And so he knows that world, and I think, you know, he could make a great old Hollywood movie, and he's made an interesting old Hollywood movie, and he gets a lot of the cool details right, but he's making that movie at the same time that he's making this Howard Hughes movie that he's apparently wanted to make for a long time, and the two paths never merge.
And doesn't he play Howard Hughes as sort of like a 50-something version of Howard Hughes, like a man in his 50s? And Warren Beatty's like 80?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, here's the thing. He plays Howard Hughes in shadow a lot, which is apparently a true thing. That like, you would walk into a hotel room where Hughes was, and like, the room would be mostly dark, and then he would come in and sit down and talk to you, and then he would leave, you know. He pulls it off. I mean, he's in great shape. He doesn't look like he's not the right age that he's playing. But it just that's not the problem with the movie.
Because, you know, like, I'm that age.
Yes, I know. The problem with Warren Beatty is a very well-preserved 70-whatever he is, you know. I mean, if you've seen him, he's been doing a ton of interviews for this thing. I mean, he looks good.
I have not seen a single one of those interviews.
I think one is with Gray Drake, which you should check that one out.
I'll watch that one.
Of course.
But I'm not watching this movie.
I'm not
interested.
Yeah, I mean, it's. No. I recommend it if you think you would be interested at all in just seeing what Warren Beatty's up to, or wanting to see a movie about, you know, 1950s Hollywood or whatever. But it doesn't work. It doesn't land. Unlike the Spruce Goose.
Okay, done.
Okay, fine.
Time on that one. We're just checking them off.
Fine. Scratch.
Yeah, scratch it. Bad Santa 2.
Yes. Which we very much disagreed about. Well, I mean, not very much, because this is not a sword I'm going to fall on for this movie.
I wish I had fallen on a sword during the watching.
I have a measure for comedies, which is where, like, there's the great ones and there's the good ones, and then there's the, did I laugh enough to justify the experience of sitting there for 90 minutes? And this one makes that last standard. I laughed enough times in 90 minutes that I didn't feel like it was a total waste of time.
I'm with you on that, you know, low bar.
Standard.
Standard. However, this is, with the exception of Brett Kelly, we'll talk about him in a bit. With the exception of Brett Kelly,
mm-hmm,
this is a god-awful waste of time. Willie
Billy Bob Thornton.
He's out of the joint. He's living in a crap Arizona motel room. Along comes Marcus, Tony Cox, and says, "Hey, you're Santa, I'm the elf, let's go do a heist in Chicago." Turns out the heist is at a homeless charity run by the guy from Veronica Mars named...
Ryan Hansen. Hansen.
His wife is Christina Hendricks. Christina Hendricks does not know that the charity is crooked. She's kind. She's nice. She puts Billy Bob Thornton to work as a bell-ringing Santa Claus. And then she has sex with Billy Bob Thornton, which is out of nowhere. See, at least in the first film, Lauren Graham had a reason to have sex with Billy Bob Thornton. She had a Santa Claus sex fetish.
Right. They kind of...
No.
There's a little...
She takes Billy Bob Thornton to an AA meeting because she recognizes that he is an alcoholic, as is she. She's a recovering alcoholic. And then there's this quick line about, "Oh, my husband never has sex with me. Bend me over this dumpster." Like, and it's... Each time they do it is increasingly degrading and again, pointless. It is a reason... for the script to talk about her breasts. And he does, and she's offended, but then she bends over in public for him anyway. The dialogue in this film is of a sort that someone, a studio person, came along and said, "Hey, you know what people really loved about Bad Santa? Profanity. You know what else they really loved? People insulting each other. So, do more of that." And that's most of the dialogue, is people talking trash to each other in increasingly profane and offensive ways. And
it's interesting that you haven't mentioned Kathy Bates at all, because
one moment.
She is the most ill-served, I will agree, in this movie.
Yes, and she's part of the heist, too. She's part of the mastermind group of the heist. She is Billy Bob Thornton's estranged mother. She is given the same kind of, you know, profane insult dialogue to deliver. I am not saying that it is wrong to have profane insult dialogue.
Or to have it coming out of the mouth of Kathy Bates.
I like that stuff. That was part of Bad Santa, the original film, and I thought it was great. Terry Zwigoff and the guys who wrote the film, Requa and
Ficarra.
And Ficarra,
and apparently an uncredited Coen brothers...
In the original film?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they have a sense of humanity. The misanthropy of Bad Santa is filtered through a kind of screwy humanity.
Which version did you see?
What do you mean, which version did I see?
There are three.
I saw OG Bad Santa.
Okay.
I don't know what...
The Zwigoff...
You're talking about.
Well,
okay.
Perhaps you should read...
I will.
Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, which details this.
I did. I proofread that dang thing.
Well, you've forgotten this part,
okay,
then.
Okay, I forgot it.
This is one of the rare cases where the director's cut, where Terry Zwigoff's preferred cut on DVD, is the shortest cut.
Interesting.
And the reason it is the shortest cut is because he took out every instance of Willie being nice to anyone, including the kid. So Zwigoff's version of this film is the darkest, most soulless one. And
okay.
the things that you remember about the film being of having humanity are probably not, it's probably the theatrical or the other version that is not the Zwigoff cut. Just throwing that out there.
I saw the version that was in movie theaters.
Okay.
Okay. That's the one we're talking
That's
about.
That's the Harvey Weinstein cut.
Fine. This one is so repetitive and so joyless. The film takes no pleasure in its cruelty. It is simply a rote kind of activity.
Exercise.
Yeah. And I was bored. I was bored after 20 minutes. I wasn't offended by the cruelty. I wasn't offended by the profanity. I wasn't offended by the insults. I was bored because it is absolutely
an endless cycle of the same thing again and again and again. The shining light in this film is Brett Kelly.
Yes, no question. He is the MVP.
Thurman Merman.
Yes.
He was, what, 10 when the first movie was made? Now he's 23. He's playing 21.
Yeah.
He delivers such a weird performance because Thurman Merman aged physically, but not mentally or emotionally. So he still acts like a 10-year-old child. And still thinks like there might the real Santa. I know you're not the real Santa Claus.
There is a certain wide-eyed wonder about him, yeah. Even though he is surrounded by the awfulest people on earth.
Right, the most despicable human beings, and he remains this pure
shining light
thing. This pure human being who is only capable of loving the people he's around.
Yeah,
and it's hilarious. He's really funny in every scene, but he's not in every scene. So you kind of have to wait for him.
He's definitely the highlight, but even when he wasn't on screen, again, not a work of genius, not nearly as good as the first one, which I'm not as big a fan of as many are.
I wrote the review for The Wrap.
Yes. Yes,
I wish I had titled it Crud, actually, because that's what it is.
But yeah,
you want a little pun there in your review titles? You always do.
I laughed enough.
I'd have done it.
All right, fine.
No, it stinks.
All right, fine.
I couldn't wait to leave the screening room.
Okay. I was not that annoyed by it, but I'm also not going to like try and pump it up to being anything more than it is.
Yeah. Speaking of misanthropy. L.
Ooh, yes. You saw it this morning. We haven't really talked about it yet, so I'm dying to hear what you have to say. It is the new film from Paul Verhoeven.
Yes.
It stars Isabelle Huppert as a video game producer. And in the opening
She owns the company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I say producer, I mean like, yeah, it's her baby. In the opening scene, she is being sexually assaulted and...
She's being violently raped.
Well, I was... Okay, fine.
Yeah. Let's not soft sell what happens in this
movie. Okay, fine. She's being violently raped. And when it's done, it's funny because I said when we were doing this with the flick, I said she doesn't respond the way you would think, but then Christy sort of pointed out that for a lot of women this is exactly how they respond. So I guess what I meant to say was she doesn't respond the way you would expect someone in a movie to respond, which is she takes a bath, she gets dressed, she tidies up. She doesn't call the police. She doesn't mention it until a couple of days later.
She goes to work the next morning.
Yeah.
Everything's fine.
It's not until she's out to dinner with her estranged or ex-husband.
Her ex-husband.
Her ex, oh, right, because he's got a girlfriend. Her ex-husband and her business partner and her husband that she tells them casually over dinner, oh, by the way, this happened.
Yes. And the first thing she does say, and this is why I'll forgive you for what you just said was, she said, I was attacked. Hmm. And then she says, I guess it was rape. But it was like...
Clearly.
It was brutal.
Yeah.
Like, she's being... She's being, like, beaten up and raped.
Yes.
Okay.
And she goes over, again, in her mind, and in the way that trauma survivors do, she reenacts it in a way that the outcome might have been different. Like maybe she would have grabbed this ashtray and hit him in the head and fought him off, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't even know how much I want to talk about what winds up happening here.
Well, it's important that we do talk about some things.
Okay.
Okay. There is
a couple.
There's a template for this kind of film.
Okay.
There's a couple, actually, there are a couple templates for this kind of film. There's the rape revenge thriller.
Right.
Where the woman is raped and then she gets revenge on the guy.
Right.
We actually talked about that in the last episode.
Or one or two episodes ago, yeah.
And then there's a kind of indie film, art house film, where the rape is the rape, and yet also it becomes a kind of filter for subsequent action. for the way we are to see the rest of the activity in the film.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of this movie, but it's also kind of not, because the stuff you think you might see after an opening scene like this
mm-hmm.
isn't what you see at all.
No, not at all.
She is... I just watched this film today, so I don't actually fully have all the words to describe what kind of character she is.
I saw it a couple of weeks ago, and I'm still working on it.
Because... She is... complex is a good place to start.
Yes.
Because not only does she want to minimize this thing that happened to her,
mm-hmm.
she also wants to find the guy.
Mm-hmm.
She also has a lot of other things going on in her life, such as she is the child of a man who is a horrible monster.
A notorious, like...
Hang on. Let's not talk about what that is.
Okay, fine.
But let's just say...
She has spent her life running from being the infamy of his daughter. Yes. The infamy of being his daughter.
Yes. He is an infamous figure in France,
mm-hmm.
and she has never been able to get away from that. And she's her face is known to the public.
Right.
So people on the street abuse her.
Yeah.
Okay. She is also the owner of a video game company that specializes in incredibly sexually violent video games.
Right.
And she is constantly saying to the developers,
to up it.
Yeah. Make it worse.
Yeah.
Make these monsters raping these women more monstrously rapey.
Yes, and make the orgasms bigger.
Yeah. Also, she is having a sexual relationship with the husband of her business partner.
Yes, played by Anne Consigny.
Also,
her son is involved with this...
A terrible person
who is pregnant with a child that is...
Clearly not his. Yeah. And then she finds out who raped her. And we won't tell you who it was, and we won't tell you what happens after that. But she finds out who rapes her about halfway through the movie.
Yes.
And then it gets weirder.
Yeah. I remember this was one of those screeners. I was watching it online, and stuff happens, and I thought, oh, well, then this is the end, right? And I looked, and there were another 50 minutes left. I was like, wait, what?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, this is...
Nothing is as you expect it to be.
No.
No human reaction is... as you expect it to be. It is the kind of film where the main woman is simultaneously on the run from trauma and also inviting it into her life.
Right. It's sort of like how you, when you have a sore tooth, you can't stop pushing it.
Yeah.
This is, you know, you were talking about how you're still trying to wrap your head around this movie. I saw it a couple of weeks ago, and I'm still working on it, because this is a movie that is so aggressively not telling you what it wants you to think about it.
Right.
Or about the characters, or about what happens to them, or how they behave, or how they respond to stuff. It's, you got to just go with it and draw your own conclusions.
And it is perfectly in keeping with the history of Paul Verhoeven's films.
Yes. And his female characters.
I'm pretty confident in saying this, since I've seen every single one of his films, including the old Dutch films.
Like, you've seen Turkish Delight?
Uh-huh. Oh, I've seen them all.
Soldier of Orange?
Do you remember?
Oh, yes, I do.
When we first moved here.
Right, you were trying to interview him for the longest time.
There used to be, I don't think it exists anymore, but there was a French fashion magazine, one of those big, oversized French fashion magazines.
An English language French magazine called...
Dutch. Follow me for a second. Dutch was the name of the magazine.
Named after the John Hughes movie.
Started by a couple of Dutch people who were living in Paris. So it was based in France. And the magazine itself was in English, so it was sold internationally. And it was one of those really big, oversized, glossy magazines that costs like $20.
Yeah, like each issue is a coffee table book.
Yeah. I got hooked up with writing for them by one of my editors, and her assignment was write a big, long profile of Paul Verhoeven.
And this was for when Hollow Man was coming out. Right.
But the Sony folks were just, they gave me the runaround. Like, not only was I nobody that they had heard of, but they hadn't heard of the magazine either.
And they couldn't wrap their head around, was it French or was it Dutch?
And they were like, is this international? You need to go to international publicity. Like, they kept bouncing me back and forth between
departments.
People. And finally they said, no, we're not doing this. This was after I had watched every film. And so, so, you know what? It didn't bother me. I mean, stories get killed all the time.
Yeah. But it gave you an excuse to watch this.
And here is, Paul Verhoeven is obsessed with women who misbehave.
Mm, yeah.
And women who respond to horror with sometimes their own equivalent horror. In the films that feature female leads.
Right.
In general, his films, for me, tend to be about bad people doing bad things to each other over and over and over and over and over and never learning their lessons. Sometimes there will be a person in the film who represents good, and that person usually suffers. And very frequently that person comes to stand in for Christianity, because he is obsessed with Christianity as well.
Wasn't he writing like some big book about the life of Jesus or something? Did that ever happen?
I don't know. Hmm. But, you know, as you know, in L, there's a next door neighbor character who is super Catholic.
Right, right.
And has like statuary.
Oh, yeah. The first hour of this movie is a Christmas movie, by the way.
Yes.
It's going on the list.
And then, you know, in films like Showgirls, The Basic Instinct, Black Book.
Yeah.
One of the scenes, well, I knew I was watching a Verhoeven movie in Black Book, in that scene where the Christians who are hiding this Jewish woman during World War II,
right,
they all get killed.
Well, they've been awful to her, and they force her to pray before every meal.
They hide her, and they keep her alive, but they're not nice to her at all.
Yeah, they don't like Jews. They're just trying to do the right thing, but they're awful about it.
So they're all obliterated.
The house gets bombed.
In a bomb. She survives because she's in the barn.
Yeah.
And the very next scene you see is her putting some happy jazz record on a stereo and just dancing around like, nothing happened to me. And that is a routine sort of thing. There is physical martyrdom that happens in his films. Mm-hmm. There is, in L, there's literal hand puncturing.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Very, very Christ-like hand puncturing.
Right. But stigmata.
The person being punctured deserves it. And so, so all of that stuff is wrapped up in his worldview of good and evil and relentless badness enacted by human beings upon other human beings.
And the roles that women are forced to play in society and the way they fight back against that.
If they fight back against it at all.
Yeah.
Or they participate sometimes in it.
And if they gaze into the
abyss.
And
it's not even women, it's human beings can participate in their own
degradation.
Destruction. You know, destruction happens and you accept more. And you might even go out looking for more.
Right.
This is a very strange movie.
Yeah.
And Isabelle Huppert is the perfect lead because she backs down from nothing.
Yeah.
I have seen, I think of any actress that I know of, I've seen her play more difficult people in more difficult films than just about anyone.
Yeah.
What was the Catherine Briot film that she was in last year, the year before? Something Abuse, I forget.
I don't remember
the name. Now I'm.
But like Michael Haneke's the piano teacher, and you know, even in Ozon's Eight Women, you know, she plays a character who's sort of a seemingly kind of two-dimensional spinster. And
Abuse of Weakness.
Abuse of Weakness.
That was right? The Catherine Briot film.
Yeah, I forgot about
that. Where Isabelle Huppert plays a woman who is
being scammed.
Is being scammed and knows it and keeps going along with it. So it's very...
And it's like an autobiographical film for Briot, right?
Yeah. It's very thematically kind of similar to this one.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I could see that.
So... this is not a film for people who do not want to see violent rape. I mean, you see it, and in her mind she replays it,
right.
And so the film replays it,
yeah.
And she replays it in a variety of ways
with a variety of outcomes,
and so
that said, however, it does not. This is not a movie that takes rape lightly, or is presenting it in any way that is exploitative or you know, gratuitous.
It is a film about rape. It is not a film that takes pleasure in that.
No, not at all.
But you know, if you can't deal with that on any level, then this is not
right. This is also a movie.
This film's quality and this film's value might not be enough for people who don't want to watch that kind of thing.
Fair enough, certainly. But this is also, I think, a movie to see with people that you can have a really good discussion with it afterwards, and give yourself the time and space to do that.
Yes,
because once it's over, you're going to have things you want to talk about.
Right. I'm at the moment. I am. I think this is a very good film.
I think it is an excellent.
And movie, I think her performance is kind of staggering.
She's up for a Spirit Award.
Oh, is she?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see if the Academy can handle the subject matter of this movie.
Probably not.
Probably not.
It opens. The opening scene.
No, I know.
Yeah, you get no breathing room.
If you're the kind of person who's going to walk out in this movie, you're going to walk out in the first 5 minutes.
The first 15 seconds.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, you know. All right, here's a movie about a different kind of woman. Moana. I'm a girl on a boat and I make the sea do things. Got a chicken. And this green rock.
Not to be confused with The Rock.
Who's in The Voice.
Who's in The Voice cast.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the new Disney...
I trip over my own mouth trying to explain the plot of this film, so you do it.
So I didn't really make this connection, but somebody pointed out, this is a Disney cartoon that doesn't have a real villain in it, which
Correct.
Is interesting. So we begin with kind of a... sort of the Polynesian version of the creation of the world, which involves the mother island and involves a demigod named Maui who, harnessed things so that now we have rain and, you know, different things. And at one point, Maui, who is a trickster and a shapeshifter, steals the heart of the mother island. And then he, in turn, is attacked by some devil, and both he and the heart are lost in the sea. And myth tells that, you know, eventually a time will come that a hero will rise and find Maui, and together the two of them will restore the heart and restore the world. This is a story that is passed along by Moana's grandmother. Moana is a young girl, and she is the daughter of the chief, voiced by Temuera Morrison, of an island in Hawaii, I guess, is what we're meant to surmise, or in the South Seas.
They don't ever really say
They don't say for sure.
Island it is, no.
She has a wanderlust and a desire to see the world, and early on has an encounter with the sea that sort of makes her realize that she is destined to go out onto the open water at some point in her life.
She communicates with the sea.
Yeah.
It
responds to her.
Yeah. Like, it's a character.
Yeah.
And it sort of obeys her.
And protects her.
Yeah.
Her father wants none of this, however, and not for the usual Disney thing of like, oh, you're a girl. But it's like, no. Oh,
that never even comes up.
Yeah, that is not an issue. It's understood. At all.
It's understood that she will be the chief.
She is
when
the next,
she's an adult.
She is the next chief, and it's important that she stick around and learn chiefy things and be the chief. But she wants to go out beyond the reef where nobody ever goes. And so along the, over the course of the film, A, she discovers that her people used to be traveling people, and then they stopped.
Right.
And B, the island is dying, and the coconuts are rotting on the trees, and the livestock is perishing, and terrible things are happening. So whether or not Dad likes it, off she goes onto the open sea. Moana is now like a 16-year-old girl voiced by a newcomer,
Auli'i Cravalho.
She's Thank you.
15 when this was made. Yeah. She just turned 16.
She's really great in this. And
that girl can sing.
She can indeed.
like I thought it was an adult. Like, this is a teenage girl singing, and she has one of those knock down a building kind of voices.
Well, you know, the girls all got a belt now. You know, that's ever since she Christina. Can, they got to learn early how to belt.
She can belt it.
So she does indeed go and find Maui, who is voiced by The Rock, by Dwayne Johnson, who gets my favorite song in the movie, a smug anthem called You're Welcome.
Yes.
All the songs were co-written by Lin-Manuel Miranda. He wants to take her boat and ditch her, but the sea has other plans and keeps the two of them together, along with her chicken, Hey Hey, voiced by Alan Tudyk.
And as, that's as, not a voice. Like, well, yeah. All it's doing is going. Bark, 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 bark. Yes, yeah. But, why did you need Alan Tudyk?
Because I think he also voices somebody else. Okay. Because they had him in there anyway. As Kurt pointed out, he was waiting for a scene with Hey Hey in the Hayloft, which is a Sullivan's Travels shout out. Anyway, so the two of them are out on the sea and they bicker and whatever, and he teaches her how to like sail and, you know, navigate by the stars and da da da. And eventually, it's about, you know, can they restore the heart of the mother island, and the, you know, what do you think is going to happen? It is beautiful. You know, I was saying in my review that, like, that, you know, for obviously in its early years, Disney was kind of tied to the sort of European, you know, Grimm Brothers fairy tale type, you know, stuff. Right. And obviously, lately, they have been expanding their worldview.
Yes.
And so this is, I think, their first tackling of the South Seas since, you know, the Enchanted Tiki Room. And it's gorgeous. You know, it's all blue water and, you know, palm trees and you know.
And as I said on KCRW this week, the water looks like water.
Yes. It's watery.
Which is important because this is an animation tech step.
Yes.
You know, they've pushed it forward a little bit. And now the water looks even more like real water.
It's like when the first Shrek came out and everybody was ooing and aahing about the body hair or the fur of things,
right,
and how that was finally, you know, looking, you could pinpoint it out in animation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the water is a thing here. You know, there are not the usual, like, there's no talking animals in this movie.
No.
Hey Hey as a sidekick is kind of just sort of a running joke because it's so, like, it's clearly been bonked on the head a lot.
It's the stupidest chicken that was ever chickened.
And and then Maui's tattoos kind of come to life and act as a sort of Greek chorus.
Yes.
But yeah, it's a charming movie, and she's a great heroine, and I think an important addition to the Disney canon of
and there's
heroines.
No love interest, so thank goodness for that.
There's no love interest, there's no princessing. It's, you know, she is proactive in getting stuff done and the hero of her own story. There, you know, she's a chosen one. You can't have everything, but it's still, you know, interestingly done. I kind of felt like it was, you liked this movie more than I did, and I liked it plenty. I have nothing against it. I just didn't feel like it broke the paradigms that much.
It does fit within the hero mold.
Yeah.
But it's so good at what it does.
Absolutely.
And sweet and thoughtful. There's so much care and attention placed on this story. And it's you can tell it's been made with, like I said, with care, with great care. Mm-hmm. There's an emphasis on the idea of the ancestors guiding you, and that's very moving, the way the grandmother is sort of reincorporated into the story,
mm-hmm.
As the story goes on. I was charmed and I was moved and I thought it was lovely.
No, it's delightful. I take nothing away from it. I mean, it's beautifully done. And then what does that leave? Just best worst thing?
Best worst thing that ever could have happened.
Best worst thing that ever could have happened is a documentary about one of my favorite Broadway shows that also happens to be a failed Broadway show.
Yes.
But has nonetheless had a very long and fruitful...
A failed Broadway show that just keeps getting done over and over.
Exactly,
again.
Yeah. Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along. This was coming... He was collaborating once again with director Harold Prince. They were coming off of a string of stage successes throughout the 1970s. And this was a play about young people, and it starts in the present day and works its way backwards. And you meet these characters as sort of jaded middle-aged people, and then you work back to them being, you know, young and naive and wide-eyed and excited about taking on the world. The original show failed for a number of reasons. People had a hard time following the story. They had a cast of teenagers in the roles, which, you know, they were great as the teenagers, but they weren't convincing as the middle-aged people. It was just kind of a troubled production. But the cast album that was recorded for it, people embraced. It's many people consider it one of Sondheim's best scores. And yeah, it keeps getting redone. There was an Olivier-winning production in London a few years ago, which Dave and I saw the Fathom Events version of. They're about to redo it here in Los Angeles with Wayne Brady at the Wallace Annenberg on its way to Broadway, I think. Hmm. So this documentary is directed by Lonnie Price, who you've seen in movies. He's the schmucky med student boyfriend in Dirty Dancing. He's in Muppets Take Manhattan. He was one of the three leads of the original of the you know original early 80s production that failed. And, you know, he talks to everybody. He talks to Sondheim and to Prince and to his fellow cast members, including Jason Alexander, who's probably the most famous of that cast now. Even though a lot of them still work in show business and other ones have succeeded in other realms. But then at the same time, he finds this amazing treasure trove of TV news footage from this ABC News story that never got done, where they had interviewed all of the cast members right before the Broadway opening. And so it's just an interesting story about this thing that was supposed to be such a big deal, and these young people who thought that they had it made and they had crossed the finish line and achieved stardom, and then it all fell apart. So on the one hand, it's as you were saying the other day, it's a documentary about failure, which is a subject that people don't address enough, certainly artistic failure. But it also kind of mirrors the show, because as the movie goes along and we start getting more and more of that ABC News footage, we go from the people as they are now as middle-aged folks dealing with having been in this failure and, you know, dusting themselves off and moving on with their lives to the very end, where we see them all dewy-eyed and excited about you know the great shining roads ahead of them. I think it's a lovely documentary.
I love the way it's structured that way.
Mm-hmm.
Going backward like the play itself does, and it does make you feel sort of all the more sad.
Well, that's what the play does,
and that's what the play does too.
It's poignant when you see these people who have...
But even more than the play, because in the play, at least, they become successful.
Yeah, so, but they're mostly sellouts in the play. That's the thing.
I understand that, but, you know, there are people in this original cast that thought, this is my break.
Right.
This is the beginning of something big for me. And for Jason Alexander, great, it was.
Yeah.
But not for most everybody else, and so...
There is a great part toward the end where there's a reunion performance as a fundraiser for this theater company that the guy directing this movie now directs a lot of theater, and his company they do an annual fundraiser, so he got the whole original cast back together to do this kind of concert of it, and it sold out because if you are a Sondheim fan at all, you hold this score, I think, in a special place in your heart, and the reason they keep restaging it is because the score is so good. They keep trying to make the book work with it, you know.
Yeah. But I do appreciate that it is about a subject that no one ever likes to talk about. Because to talk about failure is to somehow jinx yourself.
To invite it.
Yeah. And people don't like to do that. You know, all those horrible positive thinking people out there in the world who are like, oh, I just don't let these negative thoughts get to me.
The secret.
I manifest my blah, 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 blah. No, you don't. horrible things are going to happen to you.
Yeah, you ain't manifested that's life. Nothing.
Horrible things are going to happen to you. You're going to fail sometimes. You're going to fail again and again and again.
Yeah,
again.
The test of success is how you respond to failure right. and what it drives you to do next. You know? Yeah.
So I appreciate any time anybody says, ahem, we are now going to discuss this topic.
Yeah.
In a realistic way. So
check it out.
I do not have a DVD this week. I want to jump right into letters.
Oh, yeah. Do you have a DVD? I did not think about it, so we'll skip that part.
Okay. New listener. This comes from October, so not that new anymore. But this is from Joe. Hey, folks. I recently listened to the latest episode of Linoleum Knife, October 16th's The Accountant, Kevin Hart, What Now?, Shin Godzilla, and Aquarius. It was the one where you two went on a digression about how the two of you go on digressions. and will continue to do so. I just wanted to say, I recently found this podcast. In fact, as Dave was insisting that only... I'm sorry. In fact, as Dave was insisting that one only need to listen to two episodes to understand your format, I was listening to my second episode. The way he kept repeating, two episodes, only two episodes, put me in mind of Todd Browning's Freaks. Thank you very much. And I have to say,
we'll take it.
And I have to say, I'm in.
Yay, one of us.
The digressions don't bother me. I can't quite say they'd be the reason for me to tune in, but they don't bother me in the slightest. A film criticism, and I'm sure you know better than I, is supposed to remove the I from the review. But the truth of the matter is that we are humans who have reactions to art. I rely in part on the subjectivity of the reviewer, their prior knowledge, experience, point of view, etc. I just wanted to let you know that I'm staying. Now, maybe in 50 episodes... ellipsis. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
I'll say it again. The reason we do this podcast is because these are conversations we're already having.
Right.
These are conversations we were having years before we ever sat down and put two microphones in front of our face, and they are conversations we have throughout the week when we're not talking to y'all. And when we are having these conversations, we sometimes, a lot of times, most of the time, interrupt the conversation to talk about, you know, the laundry. And so that's just life. And I... frankly, do not believe in taking the I out of criticism. There are lots of people who subscribe to the idea that you should, and I do not, and I never have. I believe that the critic is writing about life. And if you are writing about television or film or opera or ballet or...
you're writing about your own
contemporary, your contemporary art, no matter what it is.
Your own subjective filter through which you perceive this stuff.
You are a voice in the world. You're not the voice.
No.
And so, is there such a thing as critical authority? Yes. And I believe it is earned over time. So, if you've written your third review and you haven't used the word I, good for you. Keep going. Do it that way if you want. But if you've written your 30,000th review and you never stopped using the word I, I'm probably going to be more inclined to read you.
There's a balance.
Just me. That's what I like. That's where I go.
There's a balance. I think that there's a way to express your own personal proclivities and experiences yes. and how those color your judgment
yes.
without necessarily being all I all the time.
Not all the time.
Right.
But not being afraid to relate this stuff to sure. the real world.
And
you live in.
I think you can write in the first person and not use the word I. And that's
sure.
the thing. But I get what you're saying. There's a middle point. There's a sweet spot.
I think about in the 80s how Cookie Mueller used to write about contemporary art. And I was a big fan of how she did it because she was wild. And she very willingly, happily, routinely talked about herself. And her art criticism was one of the things that in my limited ability to see art in the world, because I was in such a, you know, small Texas environment, not near cool museums, not near good galleries that were showing, you know, anything remotely, you know, strong or real, or she made me want to go look more.
No, and I, you know, I don't go bananas, but sometimes, like, for example, when I reviewed Brooklyn, you know, I thought it was relevant to talk about the fact that my parents were immigrants to the United States during that same period, and that's how I responded to the film. But I, you know,
you don't usually write in the first person, but when you do it appropriately.
I like to think so.
Yeah. I do it all the time. I do it constantly.
It's because you're a narcissist.
I am a complete narcissist. And so is every single person listening to this podcast. And so is every single person in the world. Also, perhaps on other planets. Here's another letter. Subject line, Claptrap.
Code name Claptrap.
Dear Pod People, this is from Scott. Dear Pod People, I am writing today out of embarrassment. I was challenged on a dating app, which shall remain nameless, to provide my 5 favorite female directors. I quickly realized I could not name one. As much as I would love to blame society for my shortcoming, this time it was mostly negligence on my part. And so a request. Who are a few female directors across time and space that a motivated person who does not watch that many movies should check out?
Well, what a great question.
I got a list.
Yes, you do.
I was recently asked to provide a list of top 25 directors. And because I don't care so much about lists, I sent my top 25 favorite lady directors.
And then I'll mention the ones you left out.
And I did leave some out. Just because, you know, lists are never comprehensive.
True.
Yeah. Claire Denis. Chantal Ackerman. Alice Guy Blaché.
How many Alice Guy Blaché movies have you seen?
Danielle Ouye. With Jean-Marie Strobe. Maya Duren. Agnes Varda. Lucretia Martel. Ida Lupino. Dorothy Arzner. Veri Chitilova, Samira Makhmalbaf, Ava DuVernay, Dee Rees, Barbara Koppel, Haifa Al-Mansour, Catherine Bigelow, Jane Campion, Mira Nair, Andrea Arnold, Sofia Coppola, Kelly Reichardt, Nicole Holofcener, Mary Herron, Lynn Ramsey, Sarah Jacobson. Who did I leave out?
I would add Rose Trochet, Shirley Clark, Gillian Armstrong.
Yep.
Joan Micklin Silver.
Yep.
And Danielle Thompson.
Yeah.
To name but a few.
Exactly.
And Cheryl Dunier.
So, begin with any one of these people.
And set that dating app on fire.
That's right.
I never get asked questions like that on dating apps. Of course, I don't go on dating apps because I'm...
When was the last time
married
you were on
to you?
When was the last time you were on a dating app?
That's true. That would be never.
Oh, Tinder. Alonzo Duralde.
Do I swipe left or right?
And while I'm on here, a list to be knifed.
All right.
10 movies that for one reason or another have changed how I think. Starting from 10 to 1.
Okay.
Chinatown.
Great.
Annie Hall.
Sure.
Bridesmaids.
Yay.
Oh, Alonzo.
Oh, boy.
It's Pulp Fiction calling.
Of course it is. Survey says...
New listener. Dear new listener, I love Pulp Fiction. Alonzo hates it.
Yes.
Kiki's Delivery Service.
Great.
Does that make up for Pulp Fiction?
Keep going.
Apocalypse Now.
Sure.
The Lion King. It's fine.
Okay.
Lion King's fine.
Yeah.
A Serious Man.
Ooh, good one.
Yeah. Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Nice.
Superbad.
Okay.
Yeah.
You are 95% knife.
All right. Yeah, 95 because I like Pulp Fiction. You don't like
it. Yeah.
All right, we're done.
Oh, I had a serious man story, but I'll just tell it some other time, I guess.
Why don't you tell it?
So I was at the Outfest Legacy Awards,
yes.
And one of the presenters to the Transparent creator, whose name just flew out of my head, you know that lady.
Soloway.
Jill Soloway, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
One of the presenters was... God, you know what? I can't tell the story because I can't remember anyone's name. So I'll have more coffee and I'll tell it next time. I promise. Write down. I'll tell the serious man story next episode. I don't want to get tweets about how we promise things and then don't deliver on them.
Just to write it down.
Yes, please
actually
do.
Write
yes,
it down.
Actually write it down because I'll forget otherwise.
Serious.
All right. Thank
man.
You. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music.
Story.
Thank you, Patreon members. If you want to become one, go to patreon.com/linoleumknife. Starting at just $4 a month, you get our LKTV, our podcast of the television.
And then maybe other things.
And then maybe other things if you go higher than that.
Yeah.
Also, if you are shopping this Christmas season at Amazon, go to the Linoleum Knife Facebook page where we routinely list like our DVD picks of the week or whatever. Click on that link. You don't have to buy the DVD, but if that was your entryway into Amazon, we get a kickback from any money that you spend there, and then we buy fiber with it.
Metamucil.
It makes everybody happy.
Every few months, this little $15 credit pops up in the inbox.
Yeah, so
it's time to buy Metamucil.
We appreciate it, so please do that. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to the Rotten Tomatoes podcast. Check out Bibbs and Whitney on the B-Movies podcast and Cancel Too Soon. Dennis, anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Schmoes Know, The Joe L. Ryan Thing, The Comics Canon, The Sewers of Paris, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can follow this program on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. Subscribe for free at iTunes. Leave us a nice review there. You can also leave us positive feedback on all the places where we stream, namely Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Podbean, Satchel, and CastBox. And if you get a, if you're on the Android, I think you can also get us on Google Play.
PodBloop.
And drop us an email at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. That's also the PayPal address you can use if you want to buy the white letters on black linoleum knife t-shirt. Check in with us first about sizes. We are out of some of them.
Not yet. We still have like one double XL left.
Okay. But
yeah.
We have lady sizes. We have men's
sizes. Else.
And we run a gamut. Yeah. So let us know what you want. We'll get you fixed up. Those shirts are $22 each, more if you live outside the U.S. And if you do, let us know where and we'll tell you how much more. And we have sold out of my the deluxe edition of my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
And the ones you saw always older in the mail.
Yes, but if you want to go buy it anyway this Christmas season, because it's a fun book with Christmas movie ideas for watching over the next 4 weeks, just go do that. I will post an Amazon link on Linoleum Knife on our Facebook page. Anyway, y'all are great, and we'll have more letters next time and more movies and all that stuff, and we'll catch you then.
Goodbye.